Yes. Without any further delay, let's start today's lecture. And it will be on binary trees and then on binary search trees. Very basic stuff. So essentially, we'll reintroduce that type which we have already seen in one of the earlier demos and look at the library of basic functions that there is already, and then in particular at a subclass of complete and of balanced trees. So this is just very elementary combinatorics on trees. So there is an existing library in Hall Library Tree that defines a tree data type and that we will be using quite a bit in this course. And this is the definition, and we've seen something like this in one of the earlier demos. So a binary tree is either a leaf, the empty tree, or it's a node with two subtrees and some information stored in the node itself. And the abbreviation is that this is short for the leaf, and this triple here is short for the node with these special angular brackets. And most of the time when I'll be talking about trees, I will be I will mean binary trees. So what are the basic functions that this library provides? We start with traversal functions that just go through the library, through the tree, and there's in order that does what you expect it to do. The empty tree is the empty list of elements, and in order of a node is the in order of the left, and append the element in the middle, and append the in order of the right subtree. And similarly, there's pre-order, where the element is as the first thing in the list, and there is also post-order, where the element is the last element in the list. Then we have size function, that tells you how many nodes there are in a tree. And I'm using this on the slides, I'm using this abbreviation of just vertical bars around the tree for the size function. And so, of course, the size of the empty tree is zero, and the size of a node is just the sum of the size of the subtrees plus one. And there's also size one, which is the same thing almost, except that it counts the leaves. So a leaf, the number of leaves in a leaf, of course, is just one, and the number of leaves in a node is the number of leaves in the two subtrees summed together. And then you can actually easily prove that this relationship holds between the two. So the number of leaves in a tree is just the number of nodes in a tree plus one. And that's why I'm using this notation here with the subscript 1 as a short notation for the number of leaves. And again, this is just for abbreviation purposes on the slides. In the actual Isabel text, you have to type in size or size 1, and it'll not get abbreviated. Then there's a height of the tree, and that's similarly basic. The height of the empty tree is zero, and the height of a node is the height of the maximal height of the two subtrees plus one. Again, I will abbreviate height on the slides with H, otherwise the formulas just become too wordy and long. And some trivial properties, the height is less or equal the size, and this is one of the key properties that everybody should know about, and I hope does know about, the number of the number of leaves in a tree is bounded by 2 to the height of the tree. And just to wake up, let's do that one on the board. So, as with many of the lemmas that we see about trees, it's an ordinary induction on trees, although it doesn't always work as nicely as that. even some simple, easy to write down properties on trees. If you do a naive induction on trees, it won't work. You need something more clever. But here it does work. It is really simple enough. So by induction, on T, and the base case we don't bother with, so we just look at the case left element right, and here we make a case distinction on whether the left or the right subtree is higher, because that will be relevant for the max function. And so we have another case distinction, and we look at the case that the height of the left subtree is less than equal to the height of the right subtree. Of course, there's a dual one where it's in the other direction. And then we just start from the left-hand side of the inequation. By definition, that's just the number of leaves in L and R. And so now we can do what?
Yeah. More or equal twice the size of R.
Yes, so what are you using? This is interesting. I wonder if this works. Let's see, because there are two things you could do, and I hadn't thought of what you were suggesting. Yes, I think that will also work. I would have done it in a different order, but let's do it this way. So indeed, this is two times the size number of leaves in R, but that's. Is that right?
I thought it was, but I don't think it is anymore.
Oh. Why not?
Oh, it took it. Because we know by...
What's the justification here? I'm getting confused myself.
Yeah, we need the induction hypothesis.
Yes, I think that's what I would have used at that point. And I got misled into thinking I could do something else. I don't think you can do something else. I think you have to use the induction hypothesis first on both of the two trees. Yeah. And so then you get what I would have been 2 to the height of left plus 2 to the height of right. And now we can use this one. So it's 2 times 2 to the bigger one, height of right, and that's of course now equal to 2 times 2 to the height of this node, because here it'll be the maximum of the two, and the maximum of the two is the height of the right subtree, and the 2 times becomes the plus 1 in the definition of the height. Anything? Can you hear any of the steps? Then we can go through the details. Okay. Then the other case is dual. I'm not going to look at that one. So that's just an example of an easy proof on trees. Then we also introduce a minimal height, and so that's dual to the height, except that the height takes the maximum of the two subtrees, the minimal height is the minimum of the two subtrees. And the way I always think about it is that if you have some tree, something like this, well, it doesn't look very nice. Something like that. That's sort of my picture of a tree, and then you have a minimal height that's like this, and the height is here. That's my mental picture of the tree. And so that means in particular the minimal height will indicate up to which depth the tree is completely filled. And yes, a trivial little lemma that the minimal height is less trivial than the height. And then the dual lemma to what we just had, here the minimal height gives us the logarithm of the size is an upper bound for the minimal height. So it's just, if we put them both sides by side, well, here the size, the number of leaves is an upper bound for the exponential minimal height, and beforehand we had the opposite, that it was a lower bound for the exponential height. So that's very introductory. Any questions so far? Then we look at complete and balanced trees. So these are special subclasses that have a certain importance. The complete trees are the ones that I think of as a triangle. Really like this, all the leaves are the same depth is one way of characterizing it. And here we are characterizing it via, well, something like that, except that we're not talking explicitly about the leaves. We're just saying the empty tree is a complete tree, and a node is a complete tree if both subtrees are complete and have the same height. So that's precisely this idea that all the leaves should be at the same depth. That's characterized by having the two subtrees have the same height and being complete themselves. And a consequence of that, and I'm not quite sure how direct now, this is a consequence, completeness is the same as saying that the minimal height and the height of the tree are the same. Let me just look at the library. I think it's one of the early consequences. Yes, indeed, that is an easy in the sense of practically automatic induction on the definition of completeness. And now we come to some further consequences. The next one tells us that the complete tree implies that we actually reach the limit of this inequation. Let me put down the two inequations again. So one of them is that the number of leaves of a tree is bounded by 2 to the height of the tree. And the other one was just the dual that is an upper bound for 2 to the minimal height. Let's just see if I got this right. Yes. And so now we are claiming if you have a complete tree, then this inequality here actually becomes an equality. So you really have, in some sense, the maximum number of nodes in that tree for the given height. And it's actually an equivalence, because the other direction also holds. If you have a tree where this inequality becomes an equality, you have exactly 2 to the height nodes, then it must be a complete tree. And the same thing with the minimal height, you also get the implication in that direction. And as a corollary, you get if something is not complete, if a tree is not complete, then the number of nodes must be strictly below the 2 to the height. So normally you have less or equal. If it's complete, it becomes an equality, and otherwise it's really a strict less than. And similarly for the minimal height in the other direction. So let's just look at one of these proofs, the one that's sort of the lengthiest one, although not terribly lengthy. We will look at the first lemma here, that if you have an equality, then it must be a complete tree. And so what we will prove is actually the contrapositive. We will show that we will prove exactly that. Sorry. Yep. So let me just write it down again. We will indeed, we will prove. Yes, I'm not sure why. I'm a little bit surprised that this becomes a corollary, because what we're really proving is directly this and not this. I have to check why the slides put it like that. It's not complete, then it's a strict less than. And the proof will be by induction on T, and ignore the base case, and we just look at the case. And now we have to, I don't know whether we have to, but what we do is we start from the fact that the tree is not complete. This is the definition of what it means to be not complete. So it could mean that the left part is not complete, or the right part is not complete, or that the two trees have different height. Those are the three possibilities, and we will look at those three possibilities and deduce from them, in every case, something that leads to this. So let me just use a bit of Isabel notation here. So we will directly prove the case. Remember, that's this proof by induction, the idiom where the question mark case refers to the property that you have to prove in the case that you're in. So this would be this property, where T is this node. And so what we're trying to prove holds in this case if, so this is again in Isabelism, where you can state a property, a conditional property, and rather than stating it with an arrow, you state it with an if, and then comes the assumption. Namely, here is the H, the height of L is less than the height of R. So we're now covering in this little property, in this sub-proof, we're covering the situation where the two heights are distinct, and in particular where the height of left is less than the height of R. And then I'm claiming what we're trying to prove already follows. And why does it follow? Well, if you have, you need, essentially, you need only one property, then you need this property up here. for L and for R. So essentially you're using that the size of the number of nodes of L is less or equal to the height of L, and the number of nodes in R is less or equal to the height of R. And that means, I think that should already that should already imply what we're trying to prove. We're trying to prove this with T being this one. So the case that we're trying to prove is really, let's write it out, is, and let's simplify it right away. So it's the number of leaves in T, so that's the number of leaves in L, plus the number of leaves in R. Is supposed to be less than 2 to the height of the tree. Now the height of the tree, because we're in this case here, is 2 to the height of R plus 1. So this is what we have to prove. And yes, and it does follow. Why? Because from this part we also get that 2 to the height of left is less than 2 to the height of R. So let's write that down explicitly. 2 to the height of left is less than 2 to the height of R, which is just a consequence of this assumption here. And now it should follow because you have this inequality, so by linear arithmetic it should follow that if you sum these two inequations, then the sum of these is less or equal the sum of these two, but this one is less than this one, and therefore it's also less than that. So it's just, now it's just really, now everything is on the board, and it's just linear arithmetic summing some inequations and using less than and less than or equal. So that's one of the cases. Of course, we will not look at the other case as well, where it's bigger than or bigger or equal. That's just dual. But let's look at the at another case. So at two, where we also I think prove case directly, if I remember. Yes, and now we assume that the height is the same, so that's not the problem, but one of them is incomplete. So we're covering all the cases of not complete. So if height of left is equal to height of R, and I think you can really write and here, and not complete one of the two, let's just pick L. And now I'm also claiming that in this case you can similarly prove this property. Why? So yeah. So we do need, again, one of the two inequations here. Let me see which case I'm in. The height is the same, and we're claiming L is not complete. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that we need of course we need this one, and we need but we need one more thing to make the implication.
We need to apply the production process on L.
On L, yeah. So we have that L is not complete, so we can use the induction hypothesis and can conclude something about L, namely this property for L. So number of leaves of L is less than 2 to the height of L. And now you can see quite clearly, if you have a less or equal here and a less than there, if you now add the two equations, then you get exactly this one, using that the height of left and height of R are the same. So if you add them, you just get the sum on the, you get the sum of the leaves that you have here, but you get the sum 2 to the height of R and 2 to the height of L, but since they are the same, it's the same as that. And now if you also take the other case where R is not complete, it's dual, and you take the other case where the height is greater than in the other direction, it's again dual. And if you then combine all the cases, you have covered all the possibilities of when a tree could not be complete, and in every case you have proved this, and so in the end it will be something like from 1, 2, 3, 4 with all the different dualities, show case, and then it'll just be something like auto. There's no more difficult reasoning to be done. Maybe even by linearism, I'm not sure. There's this proof method, linear arithmetic. So, yes.
You know that one?
Please come back. No signal.
Okay. So this was just some examples of proofs, combinatorial proof of properties of trees. So then we have the balanced trees. Complete is really rather special. Balanced is sort of one level weaker, but still very useful, where the height and the minimum height differ only by one. So you've balanced the tree as much as possible, and there's still a little bit of an imbalance, but you can't do any better than that. So that's the definition of balanced. If the height is at most one bigger than the minimal height. So the leaves occur only at two levels, and they're just one level apart, at most one level apart. And then the important consequence is that if you have a balanced tree, and the balanced trees have optimal height amongst all the trees with the same number of nodes in them. So if you have a balanced tree, and you have some other tree that has at least as many nodes in it, then the height of that other tree has to be bigger than the has to be greater or equal than the height of your tree. So if you can't manage, if you make this here an equality, then it means if you have a balanced tree and if you have some other tree T prime with the same number of nodes, then necessarily your tree, your balanced tree, will have a height that's no worse than that other tree. So balanced trees have optimal height, that's the. And the proof is, again, similar to what we have seen. So please, a warning, note that the terms complete and balanced in literature are not canonically defined. It means, for example, if you look into Knuth, he calls complete what we call balanced. And similarly with other sources like Wikipedia, so be very careful with these notions. I'm using the ones that I defined myself. So that's the terminology for this course. Now, search trees. Search trees are well known to you, and we'll quickly go through them. It's more about the conceptual framework today. And the unbalanced binary trees, I will use BSTs for binary search trees, and they represent sets. And so there's another standard function, set tree, that takes the tree and gives you back the set of the elements in the tree, and it's defined by recursion in the obvious manner. So we will be using that function quite a bit. And the nice thing about the binary search tree is that, as everybody knows, you can search, for example, a binary search tree in time O of height of T. So of course, if the tree is unbalanced, then the height is not very nice, but if it's a somewhat balanced one, then it's, the height is typically logarithmic. Today we will not looking at the balancing at all, we're just looking at the conceptual idea of using a binary search tree to represent sets, and this is just a remark on the side. And what we have defined here, this set tree function, is what's called an abstraction function, because it abstracts from your concrete data type to some more abstract representation, some more abstract view of the type, and that's in fact the view that we will be verifying our implementation against. So the implementation needs to be verified with respect to something, and the something will be the set data type, and the set tree function will bridge the gap from the implementation level to the abstract mathematical level that serves as the specification level. And what is a binary search tree? It's again in the tree library defined. It's a predicate on trees, and it's defined recursively. The empty tree is a binary search tree, and the node is a binary search tree if both subtrees are binary search trees, and if all the elements on the left are less than or equal to the element in the middle, are less than the element in the middle, and all the elements on the right are bigger than the element in the middle. And what I don't show on the slides, but implicitly it's there, I don't show it in the type here, but the type A must be of the class Lin order, so really this is what you should write. Remember, those are the linear orders, the type class of linear orders, which we introduced some time ago. And that type must be ordered is already apparent from the fact that you're using an ordering relation on it. That it's a linear order, well, that just makes things a bit simpler later on when you, from the very beginning, require this type to be a linear order. And in particular, any of the numeric types are linear orders. So if you define your binary search tree like that, it will work in particular on trees with integers or natural numbers or reals in them. Now, what are we trying to implement with these binary search trees? We're trying to implement a set interface. And what does such an interface consist of? It consists of A, an implementation type, let's call it S here, that implements the sets. And then the following functions, we must start with some set, that's the empty set. And when we have an insert function that inserts an element into the set, so it inserts something of the type of elements into the type of sets and gives you back another set. And the delete function, which does the converse. And an isIn function that tests whether given a set and an element, if the element is in the set. So this is our fixed interface for sets, we will be using that for the much of the rest of the course. And you can also similarly define a map, which is somewhat more general than a set. So a map really could, all, search trees are also suitable for implementing maps. which map elements of type A to elements of type B, and then the interface would look like this. You have an implementation type, let's call it M for map, and you have an empty map, you have an update function that takes an A and a B and a map and adds this particular mapping of A to B to that map, or rather it overrides any existing association that A may already be associated with some element, and now you update it and you associate it with that new element B here. And you have a delete function which just takes out any association of some element A with anything, takes it out of the tree, and you have a lookup function that, given a map and an element of type A, gives you back what A is mapped to, except it might be mapped to nothing, and that therefore you return an option which none, where none indicates no, this mapping doesn't map A to anything, A is not part of the domain. And so this is a more general interface. You can always simulate sets based on maps where you just consider the map to be a map to the unit type, for example, and then if it's mapped to something, it means in the set. If it's mapped to nothing, it means it's not in the set. So that would be one way of simulating the sets by maps. But for much of the course, we will not look at sets. We will not look at maps. I'm just including this interface for maps for completeness, but we will always be focusing on sets just because they're notationally simpler, not because they're more interesting. So in the specification of the binary search tree, I use the less than predicate, we will, for various reasons, we will assume that there is a three-way comparison function, which makes writing some of the functions nicer, and it's also potentially more efficient. So we don't just assume that the type A is a linear order. We also assume that there is a data type. We don't just assume that that's defined in one of the library theories. A data type comparison value, which can give you back less than, EQ, or greater than. And the definition, there's a function compare that compares two elements, x and y, and we don't have to assume that this compare function is primitive. Instead, we can define it ourselves. It says if x is less than y, it returns LT. If they're equal, it returns EQ, and otherwise it returns greater than. So this is the definition that's actually used, but you can imagine it could also be primitive on some type that you don't need to define it with these two successive comparisons, but the basic type might already come with a comparison function that gives you back these three values. But here we are actually defining it like that, and we will be using it freely in the definition of the functions. So this is just the general setup, specifications of, well, not specifications, we're yet there yet, interface for a set data type, and now we see an implementation in terms of binary search trees, because so far there was no implementation. So what does the implementation look like? It uses a tree as the implementation type, and the empty set is implemented by a leaf, by the empty list, by the empty set. The insert function we've seen already, I'll just show it because now it uses the comparison function. So if you insert an element into the empty tree, you just create the tree with a single node in it. And if you insert X into a binary tree, then you compare X with the element in the middle of the tree. And depending on the outcome, you either insert X into the left branch or in the right branch, or you simply, if you have equality, then you don't do anything, you return the very tree that was passed into your insert function. And the isIn test is similarly simple, you just recurse depending on the result of the comparison, you will recurse into the left or to the right subtree. And the only one that's a little bit trickier is the delete function. The nice thing about the insert is you always go to the leaf of the tree, and then you insert it there. The delete may also happen in the middle, and that's where the complications come. So if you delete something from the empty tree, there's nothing to be done, it remains empty. And if you delete an element X from a node, then, well, if it's less than or greater than the element in the middle, you just go down into that subtree and delete it there. And the only interesting case is the equality case. So if you're trying to delete X from this tree here, and X happens to be equal to A, then you would have to remove the element, but then you have to replace the element by something, because you can't have a node without an element in it. And so what you do is, in the special case, if the right subtree is empty, then you simply make it, well, then you can just return the left subtree, because the A is gone and the R was empty anyway, so only the L remains. And if R is non-empty, then you simply take the minimal, which means the leftmost element in R, and return it and put it where A used to be. So this is what the function split min does. It splits off from R a minimal element, let's call that A prime, and that gives you the remaining part of R. And then it returns L unchanged. The minimal element of R has moved to the middle, and the rest of R has become the new right subtree. And the split min function, I don't want to go through, this is just a well-known recursive function. So that's an absolutely standard undergraduate implementation of insertion and deletion into an unbalanced binary search tree. Now the question is, why is this correct? And this is a question, how do we phrase that? Why do we call this a correct implementation? And the basic idea is that the four functions empty, insert, delete, and isIn simulate what the empty set does, what the union with a single element does, what the difference with a single element does, and what the element function does. So they are concrete counterparts to the abstract mathematical operations you see in the second line. That's the idea, but what does that mean concretely? Because the two operate on different types. And that's where the abstraction function comes in, to bridge the gap between these two types and to express what it means that, for example, insert simulates this. What does that really mean? And that's what it means. So you take the abstraction function and say, well, if you abstract the implementation empty, then you should set. And if you abstract if you first perform an insert on a concrete tree, and then you abstract that to a set of elements, then that should be the same as first taking all the elements in the tree and taking the union with that element X. So this is what this simulate means, is that modulo the abstraction function, the function on the left-hand side and the function on the right-hand side behave the same. And with the delete, it's similar, except that here it's the minus instead of the union. And finally, is in the question whether an element is in the tree should be the same as asking if the element is in the set of elements in the tree. So here we're using again the set tree function to go from the implementation level to the abstract set theoretic level. So that's almost it. That's a bit too strong, that specification. We are requiring too much. Those must only hold, those don't need to hold for all trees, but only for binary search trees. So under the assumption that this is a binary search tree, then it should have those properties. So what we will have as an additional concept here is not just the abstraction function, but we will also have this concept of an invariant on the implementation level, the binary search tree predicate. And of course, this invariant needs to be invariant. That is, if you have a binary search tree and perform any of the operations on it, it had better remain a binary search tree. So initially, it should be the one, the empty tree should be a binary search tree. And if you have a binary search tree, both the insert and the delete should keep it a binary search tree, should preserve that invariant. And so this is really, now on two slides, you've seen the key ingredients in a specification of a data type. One is abstracting the concrete implementation to some mathematical level and expressing that your functions that you want to specify behave like some abstract mathematical functions and be some invariant on the representation and the preservation of that invariant. And now a short, so one could, in principle, given the concrete implementation we have, you can prove all of these properties and this property, but I'm not going to show you because these proofs, if you look at the code, it really is obvious that it does the right thing. And still, the proofs are somewhat lengthy. They're not difficult, but they're a little bit lengthy, verbose, and more than maybe they should. And so what I did, I investigated a little bit if one could optimize those proofs, and you can automate those proofs, but I'm not going to go into it. I'll just give you a hint of how that works. And the key idea is that you use a predicate sorted, but now it means sorted with respect to the less than relation. So that means in particular, there are no duplicates. It's a strictly increasing list. And now the binary search tree predicate can be expressed as saying that if you take the in-order traversal of your tree, then that has to be a sorted list. That is an equivalent definition of a binary search tree because you're just projecting the tree down to a single list and it should be strictly increasing when you go from left to right. And that's just another way of saying it's a binary search tree. And it turns out that this is a better behaved way of dealing with binary search trees. So if instead you use this predicate rather than this predicate, things become simpler. And if you now conduct your proofs on lists and not sets, and lists have nice, nicer inductive proofs. And it turns out that this helps a lot in automating the proofs. And automating both the simulation properties, that this function simulates that function, but also the preservation of the binary search tree predicate. But in practice, for more advanced data types, you will have two kinds of invariants. You will have the basic invariant that the data type is a binary search tree, but often you have also structural invariants, like in red-black trees or AVL trees that we will come to. And these are special balancing criteria. And those will not be, I don't know how to automate those proofs. But the basic proofs that the binary search tree remains a binary search tree after you've done some rotations on it, that's so easy to see if you look at the code, that should be automatable and that part is automatable. So that's what I'm getting to. So the correctest proofs of almost all the search trees covered in this course can be automated. Correctness proofs in terms of, yes, the insert and the delete works correctly and the binary search tree predicate is preserved, except for the structural invariants. And those are typically completely unobvious. You do some strange things on red-black trees and then you claim it's again a red-black tree. That's not obvious, at least not to me, and there I will insist on proofs, and I don't know how to automate those proofs either. They are typically special purpose proofs. So, therefore, we won't even mention these proofs. We will concentrate on the structural invariant preservations for these different search trees that we'll be looking at. So that doesn't mean that, it simply means I believe any competent programmer will see that these easy properties are really fulfilled and it can be automated, so why spend time on it here? And you can read up the details elsewhere.
Oops.
Now, a little methodological interlude on abstract data types. Because we have so far been just a bit vague, oh yeah, so there's some interface and some specification, and let's generalize the specific example that we saw with sets and trees, and look at what does it mean, what is an abstract data type, what is an abstract data type specification, how do you prove abstract data type implementations correct. So in particular, how to realize them in Isabel. And we generalize from the example that we saw, and we ignore the delete function because the delete function is just another variant of the insert function. So just to make our to shorten what we have to look at. So defining an abstract data type, what does that really mean? An abstract data type consists of an interface, which is just a list of functions and their types, plus the specification of what that interface is supposed to do. And here is the example that we had. We have the interface of these three functions because we ignore delete. And we have an assumption here that every data type describes a single type of interest. In our case, it's the type of sets. And that makes the notation simpler. And now, how do we specify something like the set data type? We specify it with the help of some existing hall type. So that's always the idea. If you want to specify some data type, then you say, oh, it behaves like sets, or it behaves like a stack, or something like that, that's already there in the system. And that serves as a model of what you're trying to do. And it doesn't have to be a primitive type. It can be a compound type of sets, of lists, of triples, or something. But you just build some abstract mathematical model with the types that you have, the sets, the lists, the tuples, functions, all the nice mathematical gadgets. And you specify the behavior of your concrete implementation in terms of that more abstract mathematical model. And the motto is that the type T, your type of interest that you're specifying, should behave like some abstract type on the HOL level. And behaves like is characterized via an abstraction function, so you should have, you shouldn't just have a model, you should also have a relationship between your concrete implementation and the abstract type. So you must have an abstraction function. Here I call it alpha, which maps values of the concrete implementation, the trees, for example, to your abstract specification, the sets. And you should have an invariant that characterizes those implementation values that really legally implement abstract elements. You specify them by invariant. So, for example, if you're talking about search trees, only the binary search trees are part of the universe of things that correspond to sets. If you have a tree that's not a binary search tree, you don't consider it a legal implementation of a set. So we also assume, in addition to the interface, with the programming interface, we assume these two additional abstract functions, the abstraction function and the invariant, and they are part of the interface, but they're not meant for the programmer, but they are for us, because we care about correctness. They must be there because we want to prove that the implementation is correct. And so, for going back to the example, you have the standard interface, and then you have an additional abstraction function in the interface, which we arbitrarily call set. We could have called it anything, we call the other one invar, that goes from S to bool. So this is just the interface of the abstract data type. Later on, we will implement the set function by a specific one, for example, the set tree function that maps a tree to the abstract level of sets. At the moment, this is just an interface that should work for any type, any implementation type S. And then you add the specification using the abstraction function that you have here. So set of empty is the empty list. Set of insert is the same as union with a single element. Is in is the same as asking yourself, is the element in the set abstraction of your implementation? So this is exactly what we had before, except that now it's on the level of an abstract ADT specification where we don't yet have committed to trees, but this implementation type S could be any type. And we have to assume that the invariant holds, and the invariant should hold at the beginning, and it should be preserved by the insert function. Of course, the isin function doesn't have to preserve anything because it doesn't modify the trees. So how does the same thing look like in Isabel? The construct in Isabel that I use for that purpose is called so-called locale. And a locale, you can think of it as a named context, a context where you have certain functions that you assume to exist and properties of those functions. And that's exactly what you can use. It's like a module specification in some sense. So it's called set here, and the concrete syntax is that you have to write fixes. You introduce, in that locale, you introduce some functions, in this case, these three functions, and the abstraction function, the invariant, and you assume that they have certain properties, the properties that you saw on the previous slide. So these is the these are the functional correctness properties that the three functions empty, is in, and insert behave correctly, plus the preservation properties that the invariant is really preserved for all the functions. So what you see here on that slide is simply the specific Isabel way of expressing what we saw on the previous slide, where I didn't use any keywords, I just used some suggestive notation. And you can find this in one of the subdirectories under set specifications. Any questions about this idea of abstract data types, their specification, interface, correctness properties? Yes?
How do we tell Isabel that we want our tree to fit this locale?
Right, that will come. Yeah. So there will be two more stages. Then one stage is how do we implement such a specification, and how do we prove it correct? Yeah. And this is first I want to explain how to write the specification in general. So we now assume that our abstraction function and our invariants have been generalized, and they don't just work on the type of interest, but they work on all types. So this is just a conceptual simplification. And on types other than the type of interest, we assume that alpha is the identity and invar is true. So we've just totalized the function so that it works on everything, and then we can write down the properties to be proved more easily. And so then the specification for each interface function on the type of interest should be the following. F must behave like some abstract function FA on the abstract mathematical level. And what does that mean? It means that if T1 up to Tn satisfy the invariant, then the abstraction of F, the concrete implementing operation applied to these concrete values, should be the same as first abstracting all of these values T1 to Tn, now raising it to the mathematical level, applying the abstract functions there. So that is simply, if you're a mathematician, just another way of saying it's a homomorphism, and the homomorphism is alpha, and it homomorphically maps the concrete implementation level to the abstract specification level. And this is the way to write this, under the assumption that everything is in this subspace of elements that satisfy the invariant. And it becomes easier to write if you make this assumption here, because otherwise you have to distinguish, is one of these elements really of the type of interest, or is it of some other type? And then it becomes notationally heavy. And now you just write in bar everywhere, and in case it's this one of the values is not part of the type of interest, then it just becomes a triviality and goes away. And then you have to show that, or the specification should state that F, the concrete operation F in the interface, should preserve the invariant. So if all the arguments satisfy the invariant, then the result should also satisfy the invariant. And so in particular, if you look at the function isIn that returns a Boolean, the Boolean is not a type of interest. So here, the in var is trivially true. So this specification just becomes a trivial specification. It's just for uniformity that I'm writing all the specifications the same way, and the ones where we're not concerned with the type of interest, but where the function returns some other type, then the preservation of the invariant just becomes a triviality. Using ADTs, why do we introduce them in the first place? Well, what's the purpose of an ADT? It gives you a context in the sense of some functions and some properties of those functions. And in that context, you can now define other functions that make use of these of this abstract data type. And here is a simple example. You could define your locale set the way you have, but you could also add more stuff. So this is what we saw already, this part up here. And here I'm saying, oh, actually, in that context, I'm defining further functions. And here, this is completely trivial example, a function set of list that takes a whole list of sets and puts them all together. It takes a list of elements and turns them into a set. And it's just by recursion, the empty list is the empty set. And if you have a cons element, then you turn the tail of the list into a set, and then you insert that element into it. And this is now defined once and for all. For every implementation of your set data type, you will get an implementation of this function automatically, because it's just a specialization with that empty and that insert for the whatever you insert here for the set part. And then you can even prove properties generically. You can prove in that abstract data type, the function set of list, what you get back will be a set, will be something that satisfies the invariant. And that's, of course, just an induction on that list, because you start out with something that satisfies the invariant, and every time you insert something, you preserve the invariant using properties of the assumes up there, which I've assumed they have these names, in by empty and in by insert. I think they are not on this slide. Oh yes, no, I didn't put the names there. But these in by empty, I guess, is this line here, and in by insert must be this line here. And if you use these two properties, then you can prove this generically. So this is just an example of how you can make use of such a interface specification and define additional functions in that context and prove properties of those functions already without ever having seen an implementation. And now comes the implementing ADTs question that you asked. And you implement the interface, so you give all the concrete realizations of your functions in the interface, and then you have to prove the specification as the next step. And for the concrete example of our set abstract data type, you have to define functions isIn and insert on the type of trees with the invariant BST. And now you can implement the locale set. And this is what this looks like. And in Isabel, the implementation is called an interpretation, because you interpret the abstract symbols in your interface with concrete functions. So that's why it's called an interpretation. And this is what it looks like for the set example. So you, you say, I want to implement the set abstract data type, and the empty function should be interpreted as leaf, is in should be interpreted as is in. I could have called the blue is in anything. I've just given it different color, but rather than choosing a different name, I could have also called this is in underscore set. That would probably be a better name than a blue is in. Insert, so this is again the one from the ADT specification, is realized by the insert function on trees. The abstraction function, which in the ADT was called set, is realized by the set tree function that maps trees to sets, and the invariant is realized by the BST function. So that's the first step in your interpretation, where you just implement the interface, and then Isabel will actually come up with a proof obligation. You will now have to prove that all the assumed properties in your ADT interface are satisfied, and then you have to start it with a proof. And then what will happen here, if you write proof, it will actually suddenly, as a result of that proof step, it will show you all the properties that you have to prove, not in the abstract form, so it will not show you set of empty equals empty set, but it will perform this interpretation up here, so it will show you the requirement set tree of leaf is the empty set. And that is luckily one of the defining equations for set three, and so that's very easy to prove. And there it is. So you then have to show all the interpreted properties of your specification. And here it's a bit more lengthy. Here you have to fix some element S, some set, and you assume that this is a binary search tree, and then you have to show that if you insert and then abstract, it's the same as abstracting the original set and inserting that element into the set. And so all the properties from the interface you have to prove in statements like that. And the system will show you what you have to prove. I don't think it... maybe you can even ask the system, maybe it gives you even the template without, of course, these proofs here. I'm not quite sure about that, but you can always see the goal state, and it'll look like this, except it won't say fix and assume. It'll say for all S, this implies this. And in our particular example where we assumed, let's go back, that let's assume our set ADT is not just the bit up there, but it also includes this, then your interpretation of the set ADT after you've proved everything will not just yield all the interface function, but it will also yield the function that you defined in there in a generic manner, and it will yield the theorem that if you apply this function to a list of elements, you get back a binary search tree. So this is where you can potentially save, because you prove things once and for all for any implementation of sets, and then whenever you give an implementation, like here, you get, as a result, you get a function on that particular realization, it returns a tree, and you get the property that you proved once and for all for that special situation. Right. That brings me very neatly to the end of this lecture. Why to the end? Because we're currently in the period where the student union asks you to evaluate the lecture course, and so the last quarter of an hour is reserved for filling in the online evaluation forms. And next time we will continue with 2-3-3s. So have a good extended weekend, and I'm looking forward to continuing on the coming Friday. Thank you.